crime to be black. And don't you act surprised when it gets vandalized. So call it what it is, call it what it is, call it what it is. Murder.
Okay, you're here with the White Privilege Podcast. I'm your co-host, Very White Guy, and as always, I'm with Unruly Rev. You can find us on Interracial John, that's J-A-W-N. We're also on iTunes, Stitcher, and other places you can find podcasts. I know it's been a couple of months, but we're glad to be back. And, you know, Rev, that opening intro song by Ben Harper, the very next bit before the chorus is something about good cops, bad cops. There's good cops, bad cops. I have to cut that out. I'm gonna start shutting down the intro song before they get to that, because I don't know if I agree with good cops. But anyway, how you doing?
I'm all right. I'm getting healthier. Been sick the last couple of weeks, but finally back. I think I'm back on track, or at least gaining ground. So that's good. And it's been busy between the last time we talked and holidays and New Year's and just a lot. So it's good to be back and be back in touch with you.
Yeah. And I don't want to even get into the toupee fiasco that's in the current Oval, occupying the current Oval Office. But in those 2 months, it just seems like, call it ethnic cleansing at this point. You know, what's going on with the legislation, everything that's going on is just absolutely absurd. But I actually don't want to talk about 45, if that's cool with you. I'm sure there's a lot of people. I'll just say there's a lot of better, smarter people talking about 45 than me, so I'm not gonna really bother, if that's okay.
I'm with you there. I'm with you there. I think there's one place we'll kind of talk about the larger political landscape, but yeah, a lot of smarter people with a lot better takes than I can do.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so the first piece on our notes here, it's a unfortunate common refrain that no one seems to adhere to or remember or pick up. Listen to black women. And the first one was Serena Williams, and it was a story about her and her doctor. Did you want to go through and talk a little about that?
Well, I think that it's certainly been in the news. If you've been paying attention here, this has been big all over the news. It was such an amazing, Serena Williams is just unparalleled in terms of an athlete, that after she was, you know, she was 2 months pregnant and able to win the Australian Open. I mean, I remember my first trimester, I came home from work and I laid on the couch and went to sleep and then just got up the next morning and worked to work. That was the extent of anything I could do my first trimester. So it's just a feat of all time that her pregnancy, and it was really followed, right? So,
and just sorry to interrupt, but sidebar, remember how, I don't know who, but a lot of people were chiming that her pregnancy was an unfair advantage as an athlete, that like it gave her some extra like estrogen and testosterone, like just they couldn't, anyway, sorry.
Yeah. And that anybody that's actually been pregnant, I mean, just the feat it is to get out of your house is remarkable. So what she did was of like Olympian, you know, not Olympics like the Olympic Games, but like of Olympian, you know, stature of old mythology, right? So, you know, this definitely, you know, followed this pregnancy and she's so amazing. And then, so I think it's also such a big contrast to see these stories come out that she also has health issues, even with being this amazing athlete. She's got, she's prone to history of blood clots and then wound up needing to get an emergency C-section, which is a complicated thing and it's a scary thing. That happened. My wife had an emergency C-section, and that's a scary thing just to happen. As it says in one of the articles that we're looking at here, the baby's heart rate plunged. And so that's overwhelming, when those happen. And while the procedure went fine, then she wound up, getting blood clots. And according to these articles and the interviews, there's a big interview in Vogue that this really seems to stem from, that you can see. She's on the cover with her baby, and so she with a history of blood clots, she knows what her body is doing. Yeah. And this is a pristine, unbelievable athlete that is very in tune with her body. She takes blood thinners. She knows what her body's doing and what it needs to be done. So when
and had when to stop those blood thinners for the pregnancy, right? So during the pregnancy, you can't be on heparin. So like, not only does she have a history, but like, she's not taking the medicine that prevents blood clots, right?
So she's very attuned and aware and paying attention to her body. I mean, this is somebody that you know, that pays attention, that knows what's happening, is very attuned. And evidently, again, according to this article, she was having an incident and was feeling the signs and symptoms coming on. And so immediately told a nurse what she needed, that she needed an IV with heparin. She needed a CT scan to check for clots, and was not believed. And was not her knowledge and her wisdom about her own body was not was ignored and wasn't followed. And so they didn't perform the CT scan. They did an ultrasound first, and then she really insisted that she get this CT scan, which then found several small blood clots in her lungs. And so they did start the medication. All of the things that she knew she needed, she was correct. Yeah. That is what she needed.
And to the title, Listen to Black Women, here's a, like you said, a star athlete, someone that's got class privilege, you assume's at a high-end facility, and they still didn't believe her. I mean, she started with, these are blood clots, get me a CT scan, start me on a heparin drip. And they had to do a bunch of other things before they finally got to the point, and then did the exact thing she said to do, who knows how earlier, you know? Right. And it could have been obviously fatal, could have been much worse. And I think, you know, beyond the racial, so there's intersections, but I personally find doctors don't always listen to patients the way, like I'm the expert on my body. I know my body. I know how I react to things. I know the side effects that things have on me. Yet doctors just, I don't say they don't care. They're like, well, we're going to give you this prescription anyway. We're going to do this thing anyway. So, you know, and I get sometimes the doctor has a decision tree. Like you start with the most common thing and you work your way down. But again, patients should, you know, be heard a little bit more. And then the intersection with being black, it is well documented that doctors believe still to this day, the trope, the myth that black folk don't feel pain. Like black people literally are under treated when it comes to pain management at hospitals still today in wide disparity. So I, you know, it must have been very discomforting and upsetting for Serena to be in a position where she knows exactly what's going on. And no one's listening to her, you know? Yeah. And I think again, the juxtaposition of she's got all the money and all the class privilege and all the,
you'd think, well, and fame,
and
right?
Fame. And yeah. Fame. Yeah. What do you think an average black woman's chances are in an ER? And so to that point, there was a Twitter thread about a nurse, and I'll put it in our notes, that had a whole thread maybe 2 days ago about a black woman she was treating as a patient and was receiving drastically, inappropriate pain management. And the lengths that she had to go through to get the appropriate pain management was just, you know, Herculean. And
well, when you bring up Twitter, I mean, that a lot of people have been tweeting and retweeting this article that came out. Cause again, I think it's a stark just contrast for what we think about her, that she, wow, there's this vulnerability there. And this vulnerability was, became dangerous, right? Became life, potentially life threatening. And so it was treated, retreated. And the numbers, I mean, I kind of stopped counting of how many people were insisting, oh, that's not racism. That's just doctors. Oh, that's not racism. That's, you know, that's just the medical community. Well, no. Yeah. In some ways, the medical community, however, there's history, like you said, well-documented recent research about racism and how race dictates what kinds of care people get within the healthcare system. It's well documented. And so, yeah, it is the healthcare system, because partially the healthcare system is set up and the belief systems that are not conscious, I don't think, is just embedded. It's just embedded. Racism is embedded within it everywhere. And anti-blackness, right? So that's, yeah, that's just part of this, part and parcel. But the white people insisting that couldn't be what it is was just like, I mean, it's not surprising,
yeah,
but come on. I mean, but listen to Black women, listen to Black people when they tell you they are treated differently over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, the simple admission that a lifetime of anti-Black conditioning has had an impact on my thinking. I have a bias. Like, just admitting that is some hurdle that as white folk we can't ever seem to get over. And that's a hurdle that enables white supremacy to perpetuate. But yeah, you know, I lost my thought. But yeah, it was unfortunate. Serena had to go through some shitty experiences. You know, I'm not by any means any expert on anything, but I assume the institution of medicine is built on a backbone of supremacy. You know, everything from who's allowed to go to medical school and be a doctor to, you know, going back to the way that we viewed Black folk as less than human. And we did experiments, Tuskegee, the history of science and medicine. It's not good with regards to Blackness, right? So I assume the institution itself, you know, again, I'm not a med student, I don't know, but I can imagine that all throughout the institution of medical training, there's a deeply embedded racial bias. I can't imagine it wouldn't be.
There's actually, if we jump into the next kind of, or one of the next things that was on our list here, Bitch Media put up a best Black women's history books of 2017. And they have a list of, I can't remember how many they are, 9 or 10 of them. But one of the books in their list is called Medical Bondage, Race, Gender, and the Origins of American Gynecology by Deirdre Cooper Owens. This book specifically looks at these early gynecologists and how what their experiments that are still used. I mean, the remnants and the legacy of what they did in terms of looking at gynecology, how it absolutely was their experiments were at the expense of Black women.
Wow. And I'm trying to find the article, but I'll put it in the notes. Sharonda Brown's an awesome Black woman, a writer, thinker. She's on Twitter and Facebook and does a lot with reproductive justice and sort of the racism embedded into those systems. So I'll try and find one of those articles and include Sharonda's Twitter because she's a great follow and is one of those people that's much, 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 much better versed on these topics. But that Bitch Media is a great list. Excellent. I'll just read a couple. Colored No More, Reinventing Black Womanhood in Washington, D.C. by Trevor Lynn. Lindsay, and that was March 2017. These were all released in 2017. Oh, fantastic.
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, Jane Crow, The Life of Pauli Murray by Rosenberg, forgive me. Okay. Well, we'll put this in the list. This is really good. I hadn't seen this yet.
Yeah, there's some great, and one of my favorites, Brittany Cooper. Love Brittany Cooper. She's got a book in here, but Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. She's fantastic. So there's some great books in here if you want to. And the opening piece here, it says, I'm just going to quote from the opening part of this. History is often seen through the lenses of male figures and historians. Yet there's an array of female and non-binary historians, scholars, and writers who are pushing Black women's stories into the canon. And so that's what you'll get with these 9 books. And these are, again, all brand new. It's not like you have to go back and there have only been a few written over the course of a decade. No, these are just ones that were published in 2017. So
excellent.
It's pretty exciting. Great books. And something, again, if you're going to, you know, think about history, listen to a Black female non-binary historian and point of view that's going to give a different vision or version of history that is not the one that we are taught in school or in public forums typically.
Yeah. And on Twitter, Brittany Cooper's Professor Crunk, I believe. Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah. Another really excellent follow. Someone's really great. Let's see here. Where are we? Lost my notes again. Do you want to talk about surprise? This is more back to 45.
Well, I mean, I think it's not just though, the over the last couple of months, the open and now unfettered racist language that is existing and is just part of – it's becoming normalized because it's so prevalent all over, right? Certainly in media, certainly, but you know, then in schools and in neighborhoods and things that are happening, you know, it's trickling down. The thing is that why I put this into this section is kind of the surprise and the shock. Well, wait a second, you know, this Joe Arpaio, right? Joe Arpaio is running for Senate, you know, is running for Senate down in Arizona after he was, you know, convicted of a whole series of things that really go back to racism.
Yeah.
Right. That's really what it comes down to. And the surprise kind of not just by liberals, but certainly on the part of white people is at how brazen it is right now. And where did this come from? And you know, how come it's overtaking? Well, the reason I have it here in terms of listen to black women is we've been told for eons, right? But certainly in the last 3-4 years, we have been told by black women, by black men, particularly by black women, femmes, trans women, genderqueer black people, to pay attention and to know, and that this is not so far undercover. We've been told. And so the surprise is this, like, really? Come on, folks.
Yeah.
Come on.
And you know, the thing that's been really irking me is that the accolades keep going to these old white dudes that are like calling it out, right? Like you're now calling Trump or like just the other day, Anderson Cooper was like splashed. Like, Anderson right. Cooper says it's racist. And he used the word racist and said, like, let's not equivocate. Let's call it racist. Like now you want a cookie now?
Yep.
You know, like now you want a cookie? Well, how about when he said there was real good people on the side of the Nazis?
On both sides.
You know, like this way too late, way too late. And I apologize to Sharonda for not having this before. And I should have remembered it was an amazing article, White Women in Robes, White Women in Robes. And it was in response to all of these handmaid tales. There was protests that women were doing as handmaids wearing the, you know, handmaid tale sort of outfits. But an excellent essay talking about reproductive violence and the intersection of race. And I apologize. I forgot that title was terrific. There's even a better headline image. It's got half of the women doing a protest in front of the DC Capitol, like in 2017 or 2016 with the robes. And then the other half is literally women in KKK robes. Very, very apt title, Women in White Robes, or Women in Robes, rather. Great stuff. Awesome articles to read. I guess let's shift to MLK, because Monday is going to be MLK Day. And I don't know where to begin and what to go with, but we used to live in Philadelphia, and every year they do, and I think they do this at a lot of places, they had it called the MLK Day of Service. And corporations like Comcast, they're real big, and it's their headquarters, they'd shut down. They'd say, okay, it's a federal holiday, but instead of coming to work, you're going to come to the office, and we're going to get into buses, usually school buses, and we're going to go clean up and paint schools. And it's like, you know, tens of thousands of people participate in this day of service kind of thing. And it is the most diluted, watered down, just whitewashed pile of crap that, like, we've dilapidated schools so poorly through a variety of things, from white flight to gentrification to whatever it is. We've dilapidated these schools. And now one day a year, bunch of white people are going to get in a bus and go paint them up, and we're going to feel good about it and call that an MLK Day of Service. It would, I don't know, but I assume it would make MLK roll in his grave. That's what we do on his birthday. That's the, at least in Philadelphia. Is that, do you guys do that in St. Louis too? This day of service weirdness?
They might. I mean, I don't have a regular corporate type job, so I don't see some of that stuff. But I will say that at the school district, I got an email actually this morning, kind of this weekly wrap up thing that we get. And one of the things that they're talking about is they're calling it, and I'm not sure where this started, right? So I don't know the origins of this. I know it's not just in this school district, because they were pulling resources from some, you know, websites of national organizations. But what they're calling for using this weekend, Martin Luther King weekend, to start with between Martin Luther King weekend and Valentine's Day, doing 100 acts of random acts of kindness. And starting with and citing, you know, Martin Luther King as kind of the inspiration for this, is having random acts of kindness. And again, wow, it's just, there's nothing wrong with doing random acts of kindness. I think that's an important thing. And that's something that I certainly want to instill in my kids, right? That's definitely something I want to instill. However, that's not the legacy of Martin Luther King. That's not actually his legacy. That's not actually what he was out fighting for, was people to be nice to each other. He was fighting for freedom and equality. And that's not the same as being nice to someone. And I think that's something that gets conflated for white people a lot. And this goes back to the thing that you talk about, and we haven't talked about it so much probably in the last couple episodes, but this feeling, right? That idea that racism is a bad feeling. And so if I don't have that bad feeling, then I can't be racist, and I'm not perpetuating white supremacy, because that is equated with bad.
Yeah, horrible.
And so
no good racist.
Instead, we're going to just feel good, and that somehow that good feeling of being kind to one another is going to eradicate racism.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, with that, not that it's related, but we're talking about MLK and the sort of quotes and how people view MLK, you know, and just like Muhammad Ali, like in his time, people fucking reviled him. They hated him. And now, posthumously, many, many decades later, we white people kind of we malign the history to make us feel better about this individual. So with Muhammad Ali, it was like, you know, he went from we literally tried him as a war criminal, right? Like a dissenter, and we, you know, could have thrown him in jail, all these things. And now it's like he was a conscientious objectioner. Like literally the language went from treasonous war, whatever, to, you know, like honorable conscientious objection over time, right? And MLK with quotes, it's the same thing. Like the number of people that use a snippet from Letters from Birmingham to literally perpetuate white supremacy, it's outrageous. The whole like measure of the content of the character, and they stop right there. Well, you know, we shouldn't have affirmative action. You should, MLK said content of character. He didn't want affirmative action. Read the whole fucking Letters from Birmingham. Get to the part where he talks about liberal complacency. Like keep going. Don't stop with that one quote.
Yeah. And we'll put this in the notes, because there's a great Salon has a concise article here. It's called Martin Luther King Jr., The Radical, 9 MLK Quotes the Media Won't Cite. These are some pretty good ones. These are some pretty good ones. That again, people even from the quotes that are here, people love. I remember I have family members that did this here during the Ferguson uprising, who would try to pick, like, here's one here. But it's not enough for me to stand before you tonight and condemn riots, and they would end it. That would be the quote that they would
use. Yeah.
And I say, wait a second. The very next sentence says, it would be morally irresponsible for me to do that without at the same time condemning the contingent, intolerable conditions that exist in our society. These conditions are the things that cause individuals to feel they have no other alternative than to engage in violent rebellions to get attention. And I must say tonight that a riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. And it has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice and humanity.
Yeah.
So this there's some great ones in here.
You know, I would even challenge, I'll just talk about I statements and not too different from MLK, but in my journey, I had to come to grips with the fact that what I knew about race was deliberately fucked up. Like, you know, that was deliberately by design maligned in a variety of ways. And one of the things that really was eye-opening to me was information about the Black Panther Party. You know, like I wasn't that age, right? Born in, you know, mid-70s, whatever. But everything I heard, every piece of information I ever got about, you know, Huey and the Black Panther and all this stuff, it was so just deliberately bullshit. When I actually started learning more about what they did and the changes they made in their community and why that got the ire of the government, right? Self, what do you call it? Self, self-sustainability, right? Wasn't mm-hmm. something that they wanted the Black Panthers to have. But no, it really, it changed everything I thought I knew about it. And I, you know, to some degree, I had to do the same thing with Martin Luther King. Like, mm-hmm. you know, what I've been spoon-fed deliberately is kind of fucked up. Like the article we're going to link to, I don't know if there's this, I'll put the other link in there, but there's a whole string of right-wing conservative people that are literally using MLK's words to abolish affirmative action in their states and legislations. Like literally saying, where's this one quote? This is, Newt Gingrich praised King. Where no, I was there. Politicians have picked up rhetoric to justify rolling back civil rights legislation. Governor Mike Foster of Louisiana signed an executive order on January 11th to abolish affirmative action. He presented the act as a fulfillment of King's dream. And this is Senator Governor Foster saying, "I can't find anywhere in King's writings," he's quoted in the New York Times, "that King wanted reverse discrimination. He just wanted to end all discrimination based on color." And it's like, that was from the 90s, but that still persists, that like,
yeah.
that, you know, this notion of reverse discrimination. We'll get to that. If we get time today, there was a class in Florida about white racism that had that's ancillary related. But, I don't know what other people do for MLK. But if you're in Philly, don't get on the bus and paint schools, please.
There was certainly the criticism certainly here during the Ferguson uprising, and then it happened around the country too, but particularly here when the actions were closing highways and closing bridges, that Martin Luther King would never do that.
Yep.
And that criticism that came from, you saw that on the news, you read that in print, that Martin Luther King would never close down highways. Well, what is the Pettus Bridge? What was Selma? Selma was this image of walking across the bridge was closing down a highway.
Yeah.
Let's take one of the most iconic images. And then, over and over again, this is not, it's just this idea that MLK would not be down with what's happening within the movement for Black Lives is just asinine. It really is. He's being used as a tool of white supremacy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is asinine. It's just absurd.
So do more than just think about being kind. If you're talking to your kids, let's talk about what discrimination is really about. Let's talk about why we're still in this argument, in this fight, why it's still important. And yeah, random acts of kindness are really important. And I think empathy and sympathy and compassion are really key experiences and notions and things that that we want our kids to have. What is not okay is taking that language and trying to separate it from that somehow that compassion and empathy takes the place of justice.
Yeah, it's a Herculean feat of whiteness that we've taken Martin Luther King Jr.'s words to literally ban affirmative action and to use it as a cudgel against modern protest movement, you know?
Yeah.
I always used to use that as my litmus test when I was talking to new people that I didn't know. And I, like, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, like, you know, "Oh, what do you think about Black brunch and highway shutdowns?" Your answer to that tells me an awful lot. And Black brunch in particular was like, I don't want to say I had a lot of hard conversations with people in my life, but people that I care about that I think of as having a decent understanding, they're like family members, right? The people I'm in community with that were like, I just don't think that's the way to do it. And if I was eating brunch, I wouldn't like that. And I'd feel this way. And I was just like,
Exactly. That's the point. You're supposed to be uncomfortable. That's where we are. White supremacy should make us uncomfortable, and our own complicity in it should make us uncomfortable. We should feel awful when confronted with this. And that's more likely to get you to do something to change than just pouring pink paint over it and wishing that it would go away.
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, there's the, I think of, again, my journey has had sort of a path, and I know other white folk that have had similar paths. But it for me, it went from, you know, I knew, but I was absolutely apathetic and asleep at the wheel. And then in sort of quote unquote waking up, you know, I absolutely had a guilt phase where I was like, I got to do everything and I feel so bad. And then from there, the pendulum swung the other way and I ended up getting a little bit kind of sitting on my laurels. And so, you know, you kind of have to constantly remind yourself, at least me as a white person, to be active and to learn more and to shift power and resources to the Black community. Cause if I don't, like, literally being, it's not enough to be colorblind. And I hate that fucking word because it's bullshit. It's not enough to simply be, you know, diversity focused. We need to be actively anti-racist, actively taking down these systems, but not being active, being sort of complacent and be realistic. Let's be honest. If you're being complacent, if I'm being complacent, I'm upholding this system of supremacy. Every day, living and breathing, I do something that maintains this system of supremacy. And if I'm not actively taking it down, I'm actively maintaining it. And, you know, for me personally, I've had to struggle with that. That, you know, I went through this white guilt phase where I tried to do everything and then I didn't do as much. And then, you know, a period of time will go by and it's like, oh, I haven't really been active and I'm going to, you know, do some more. But making it a consistent daily habit to, you know, think about shifting power and resources and think about where you have power. You know, like that quote that senator had or the governor had about Martin Luther King didn't want this colorblind dream. And I just lost my thought again. I'm terrible today. I don't know what's going on. We should record it at a different time.
Well, one of the things that just to kind of springboard off of that is now you've got me doing it. Now I've lost my train of thought. Oh, is that I've said this before. I really do believe that this is a spiritual practice. It takes that kind of attention and dedication that and treating being actively anti-racist and fighting for justice is a spiritual practice that is something that we have to incorporate in our actions, in our hearts, in our minds, in our prayers, in all of the different places, in all the ways and levels of our existence. It's that kind of level that it takes a spiritual practice, because doing just one thing won't create the change that we claim we want, right? It's not one thing. We can't think our way out of this, because if we could have thought our way out of this, it would have happened by now. There's a lot of smart people that actually I trust and I believe do want this to change. If any of us could think our way out of it, we would have thought, if we could educate our way out of it, we would have educated our way out of this. That's not what's going to do it. No. It's the daily practice. It's the spiritual practice. And when you fall off, you jump back on. When you make a mistake, you apologize, you make amends, you find a way to have reparations and care, and you get back into relationship. And those are the things that may allow change.
Mm, good point. Yeah. And you're right. It's got to be, you're a reverend, and I have some spirituality that we share. But I agree. It feels as when I'm doing good work, it feels like heart work. It feels spiritual to me. And to be clear, that's very different than the sort of ally cookies most people want, you know, like I've struggled with this. I'm a white dude at the heart. I'm still a white guy. And my reinforcement history of 40 years has been being a white guy and getting things my way and handed to me. And I, you know, going into that white guy mode, it's like, it's not even a glove. It's literally the skin I live in. And I revert to that as a default. I live in that as a default, unless I actively don't live in that modality. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not going to become unconscious for us. It's not going to become automatic for us. It's going to have to be conscious. And that means that we have to be aware of things, which means we can't pretend like it's not there. And that's going to make us uncomfortable. And so part of, I think this spiritual practice, I believe for white people, is about finding a way to be okay with not feeling okay all the time.
And for me, finding a way and being okay with not fucking being the, you know, having answers. Like, I don't have the answers. I don't know. And I think that's someone smarter than me has had a list of traits that actually are framed by supremacy. Mm-hmm. And one of those traits is the sort of like, I can fix it. We can do it. We can solve it. And, you know, the quote I come back to is only the oppressed can free themselves and only the oppressed can free the oppressor. And, you know, that's why I come back to just shifting power and resources. How can we move power and resources? Where do I have power and how can I shift it? And we're, you know, again, I'm going tangent, but the Me Too movement, right? We're seeing a, you know, someone called it a tectonic shift. I forget the woman at the Golden Globes called this a tectonic shift. And I think that's accurate. It feels, you know, fundamentally different than it's ever felt with regards to men in power and sexual harassment, right? Like the conversation, the language, everything has changed pretty drastically. But it's,
well, not just language. There's actually been some consequences, right? Not everywhere, but there actually have been some consequences, which hasn't happened in the levels that it has lately.
Yeah. Let me roll back the word drastically. It feels, the Overton window feels like it's moved a lot. I don't know if anything has actually changed when you see Michelle Williams getting 1% of Mark Wahlberg's reshoot, you know, or you see, you hear about Kat leaving the E! Daily Show because she's getting a fraction of her male co-host. So I don't know if things have changed in any way practically in reality, but the Overton window feels like it's moved quite a bit. And what it feels like is shifting power back to women, you know, moving. And when we talk about equitable pay, it's not just money. It's, you know, power. It's where decisions are made. And women are asking for a seat at the table. The most recent election, after that, we saw more women apply for political positions than we've, I think, seen ever, right? So there is this shifting of power and resources on that side. We got to do the same thing with race. We've got to shift power and resources to those that are most marginalized.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, and just to wrap that up with MLK, I just reread Why We Can't Wait by Martin Luther King Jr., it's a great book, and he has such a strong, and people don't talk about this. Towards the end of the book, he makes a very strong demand for reparations and actually has a plan of for reparations to African Americans. You know, that's again shifting resources, and it's monetary reparations. It's clear it still will never pay back what is owed, but it begins to get some leveling of a playing field and kind of a catching up to some degree. And that nobody ever talks about MLK, at least white people, I should say. White people never talk about the fact that he was demanding and heading down that path to demand reparations.
I myself had not heard that before.
Yeah, it's all over the end of that book. And it wasn't just like a general thing. He had a plan, and he spells it out in Why We Can't Wait as to how it can happen. And it's pretty interesting, and it makes a lot of sense. The plan makes sense, right? Reparations make a lot of sense. But even his plan was like, you know what? That could happen. That's not some big idea that you can't figure out how to get it down into doable pieces. This is really doable. So yeah, that shifting of resources is key.
Yeah. So we've got more time, and if you've got more time, can we keep chatting?
Sure.
Okay. And I apologize. I fucked up the notes, and we had two different topics. So this show sounds like garbage, and I apologize. It's been a couple of months. We're rusty. Forgive us. But so I had a bunch of stuff that I thought was sort of interesting. I've seen corporations and businesses, I don't know, for lack of a better word, fucking up and doing various things. And there was even an article where someone, B. Kwame's fantastic writer, talks about H&M's racist hoodie incident being perhaps deliberate, right? That manufacturing outrage within the Black community is possibly a way to generate sales. You're going to get eyeballs, right? You know, right. It's I forget what they call it, but exposure trolling, right? Mm. You know, they're looking for outrage. They're trolling to get exposure. And I'm sure it works, you know, like I'm certain the number of people that were outraged with that sweater, there was a fraction of people that wanted to go out and buy it right there from seeing the outrage on it. But so, I guess
let's jump in and talk about that since we're already talking about that. Let's jump right down to that one.
So if you didn't know, H&M had an ad campaign. I think it was I don't know if it was an ad campaign or the magazine that comes, you know, their photo shoot with their advertising, whatever it is. And they had a bunch of different pictures, and they had little, it was for kids. They had little white boys and girls, and they had some black kids. And they put the black boy, the only black model, in a hoodie that said "Coolest Monkey in the Jungle." And at this point in the year of our Lord, 2017, 2018, if you're not aware that there's a rich history of black people being inappropriately compared to just animals, in particular monkeys, that history is so fucking long and rich, you literally would have to be, I can't imagine how you wouldn't know that, right? So for me to think that H&M didn't know this, or they didn't have any black people on staff at all, you know, it's almost too hard to fathom that they literally didn't know that this is what they were doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. There's a great article that we're going to post with it. B. Kwame, of why I don't buy the H&M's apology for the racist sweater. There's so many layers of people that have to have their eyeballs on that to take a look at things before something gets released.
Oh, at a place like H&M? Oh, 100 people looked at this.
Right. 200. And yeah, it's not an American company. This was part of a UK, evidently this was part of a UK campaign. And yet it's an international company that of course is going to be seen here, and their stores are all over the US, right? So there's no way to not pay attention to that and to not notice it. And beyond that, like, so there, this is a good article. And some of the ways that you think, okay, well, was it just a mistake? Again, people had their eyes on it, and somebody could have said, you know, or maybe there were people that said, hey, stop, but nobody wanted to listen. My guess is it could have been some black women that were not listened to go back and circle back to our original topic, right? Evidently in the same catalog, and I don't have it up here, but I have it in another – oh, wait. I have it in another article that we can pull up. So there was also another picture in this catalog or in this campaign was a white boy wearing a hoodie with the words "Mangrove Jungle Survival Expert." So you've got a white kid surviving the jungle, right? Or, you know, in terms of colonization, taking over the jungle, being able – to, you know, be in charge. So there's no way that is so unconscious. Well, it could be unconscious, but it means people are intentionally and well, it's not unconscious. They're consciously trying to avoid, or trying to, like you said, drop this in to get a lot of clickbait.
Yeah, I think the other, and there was a, and back to the sort of inappropriate conflation of black folk, a woman, Jennifer Eberhardt, a psychology professor at Stanford, did a 2008 study that showed Americans, even those born after Jim Crow era, still subconsciously associate black people with apes. And Eberhardt said of this, it was the most depressing work they've ever done. And so this is 2008, you know? And so I have this discussion with a lot of my white friends about outcome and intent and sort of how things happen. And again, we as white people think racism is this sort of like overt thing that you think and feel and do, that you have like, this is how I think and feel in my mind and my heart, and then I act on it. That's racist, right? We don't think of unconscious bias having racist outcomes, right? But so I use the 2008 economic downturn as an example of this. Like, was there a group of people that sat around and said, you know what? We're gonna package mortgage derivatives and we're gonna sell them, and it's gonna create a bubble and it's gonna burst and it's gonna virtually wipe out all black and brown people's economic home value, and white people will be able to survive it and it'll be no big deal. No one sat around and said, we're going to do this. Like I don't believe there's a Illuminati that sat around and was like, we're gonna fuck the entire black homeowner community in this way. I don't think that exists. There was no cabal that sat down and did this in a back office thing. But in an entire system that is built on oppressing black folk and benefiting white folk, decision after decision after decision is made. And when these thousands of decisions end up like a million paper cuts bleed you to death, you can't be surprised that happened. It's like, you know, so it's not that people sat down and deliberately did this, maybe, but bias and other things allowed this to happen, right? So it's kind of like, did we deliberately do the economic crisis in 2008? No, but all kinds of deregulation, all kinds of bias, all kinds of things allowed that to happen. I think H&M's trolling black folk, but let's pretend hypothetically they're not. I don't think they sat down. Maybe they did. It'd be horrible if they sat down and said, we're going to put a black kid in this shirt. Even if they didn't do that, a number of biases played in that, a number of decisions, including not having black folk there, including having all white board of directors. It's just decision after decision after decision that benefited white people and excluded black people ends up with H&M having an advertising campaign like this. You know?
Right, because even if they weren't actively trying to hurt black people with this, they weren't actively trying not to.
Exactly. That you did exactly. Well, that took about 10 minutes to say what you paraphrased in one sentence.
They weren't actively trying not to. And that's really where we are as white people. That's what we have to be doing. That's the spiritual discipline. How can I actively try not to hurt people?
Yeah, actively. You're absolutely. And that's if these folks didn't deliberately and actively harm black folk, which I kind of agree with B. Kwame that they did, they certainly actively allowed supremacy to play a role to getting to this point, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it took several apologies. Their second apology was actually not a bad apology, but it took a whole lot of social pressure and a lot, you know, just it took a lot of pressure, including some real big celebrities that The Weeknd, I guess, was associated with the
musicians
brand, and The Weeknd pulled out.
Yeah. It's funny. I woke up this morning to seeing stories. This is how you do an apology. Thank you, H&M. Like literally, like almost as if like, and we see this all the time that racist outcomes, or, and I say, I'll go back. Doing anti-oppression and anti-racism work, it's going to benefit white folk materially quicker than it will black folk. That's just fact. Just like affirmative action is going to benefit white women sooner, it's going to benefit black folk. That's just like it is. It's reality. And with that's like the third time I lost my train of thought. I don't know where I was going with
apologies.
That. Oh, apologies. You know, seeing H&M get kudos for apologizing for harming black folk is fucking disgusting. You know, I mean, it's literally like fucking grotesque. Like my wife had an incident with an individual and it wasn't good. They fucked up. It was like a racist incident. This individual is now going about using that incident where she harmed my wife as a credential on how to talk about race. They're literally getting work as a like white person doing anti-racism work, and some of their bona fides are navigating a situation where they fucking harm my wife. Good Lord. Like, good God. And that's why I
wish
feel like
I had that audacity. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That's disgusting.
But that's what I see with H&M. I literally woke up. I was like, wait, that people are applauding their apology. And even people on Twitter were like, you know, cause they know we rate apologies on the John. Like, you know, what do you think of this? The second apology did hit the mark. And it's like, I don't fucking care. You know what I mean? Like, I guess I care that they actually got it right the second time, but I care that they don't do it again. You know,
that's what it comes down to. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about the apology stuff, really since a lot of the pieces happened with just apologies in general, I think about a lot. And one of the things that – I don't know if we've talked about it yet. One of the things that's just so basic, right, that the words are one thing. But it's so basic. My kids, they watch Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. And if I've said it on this podcast already, I apologize. Or maybe it just needs to be said again. Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, which is, you know, it's a kids show. It's on PBS. And they sing these songs to get you to remember everything, right? So when it comes to apologies, the song goes, saying I'm sorry is the first step, then how can I help? There's a second part to it. And even little kids, I'm teaching my 2.5-year-old, saying I'm sorry is definitely the first step. You definitely have to do that, where you actually say you're sorry. But then is the next part. Then how can I help? What can I do? Can I make it better? What needs to happen to repair this relationship? What is that second step? And if there's no second step, the first step doesn't matter. The first step is then literally just lip service.
And frequently starts with it by saying, I apologize if you were offended. That's not I'm sorry. That's not I'm sorry at all.
No. Alrighty. We could do a whole thing. Maybe we should do a whole thing on apologies at some point. I have a lot of thoughts on apologies.
I tell Leslie, we haven't done an Interracial John podcast in ages, but the number of apologies that are stacked up and the number of fucked up white people and yes, all cop stuff. It's just the folders. It's bursting.
I still have thoughts about the Kevin Spacey one that you guys did on your last one. And I still have thoughts about that. So yeah, I have lots of thoughts about this.
Yeah,
maybe we'll do it. We'll do a sideshow sometime.
And again, side note, there's been more than a few high profile people that have been caught with the Me Too sort of harassment issues. There's been a few that seem like their money's making them kind of untouchable, the Weinstein kind of stuff. But I don't know. Kevin seems to be of the high profile men caught up in this. He seems to be have excoriated, you know, cut out from Hollywood, ablated so rapidly and quickly. I think in part because of that fucked up apology.
Well, he's also gay.
Oh, sure. The intersection of that. You're right. Forgive me. That was the first most obvious one. But I don't think that apology helped either.
Listen, but that apology isn't actually that much worse than most of the apologies going out there. It was bad, but compared to most of the other ones out there, it's kind of on par. That's just sickening that that's what is considered, you know, that's considered an apology. I mean, first of all, we could go on this. We'll have to do another show.
I'm just thinking the points we have for an apology, one of them is an explanation of what happened, and boy, did he mess that up.
Oh, yeah.
That was grotesque. I referenced earlier in the show, and there's no way to segue, so we're just going to go, about a university that had a course on white racism. And it's quite interesting. It was a university in Florida. Let me get to it here. Florida Gulf Coast University. I had a class on white racism. Professor Ted Thornhill, assistant professor of sociology, said, we've got to be cautious because you didn't know what people are capable of. Oh, I skipped the article. Sorry. First, there's a class on white racism. And professor says, all it takes is one person to act on their views. So he's having this class on white racism. And I'll just read the course description, which I think is amazing. And every student should be taking this class. White racism class will interrogate the concept of race, examine the racist ideologies, laws, policies, and practices that have operated for hundreds of years to maintain white racial domination over those racialized as non-white. It aims to discuss ways to challenge white racism and white supremacy toward promoting an anti-racist society where whiteness is not tied to greater life chances. Man, is that, I want to take that course. You know, like, that's fantastic. And because of that course description, Professor Thornhill got harassing emails, threats, openly racist harassment, and they had to post an armed police guard outside the class. Like, just think about that for a second, that a Florida Gulf Coast, just a university campus, wants to talk about race in a classroom setting. This is where it should be discussed, right? In our educational system, we're going to train young minds. And the mere course description was enough to get white people so upset and so fragile that they were exhibiting racist harassment towards Professor Thornhill. And it's so much so they had to get armed guards outside the door. That's just absolutely bonkers. Just, he had 46 pages of emails. Not 46 emails, 46 pages. And pages and pages of emails. Florida Gulf Coast isn't that big a school.
Yeah, but it doesn't take much for once that word gets around on that, you know, that part of Twitter or that part of Facebook, it won't take long for people to find that email address and start sending it in from all over the country. I mean, you know, and so if you read this article that we'll post, you know, they list some of the emails or the threats and they're just. I mean, disgusting. Yeah. And that's not surprising, right? It's not surprising. I mean, I love some of the things that he talks about and the professor, Thornhill is African American. And, I love that he told CNN, it's not my job to provide white people with comfort. You know, he said it never at any point entertained the possibility of changing the course title to accommodate the racial bigotry of the individuals who would send me these kinds of messages.
Yeah. And I love even the course description focusing on whiteness and the advantages it gives. And then even describing those racialized as non-white, you know, because whiteness is malleable. But no, I, it, it goes on to say in the article, there's over 100 incidents of these types of harassment at courses and classes last year alone. And this is not the first time. There was a professor that had the same class, white racism, Noel Sazenev, sociology professor at University of Connecticut in 95. And the University of Connecticut shelved it twice amid widespread publicity. I remember that in 95. I was in college at the time.
You know, and that's so we can't talk about it, right? That's how much we can't talk about this. Right. Yeah. We cannot study it. We cannot look at it in a critical way of what white racism is all about. We cannot, that has to be stopped.
Yeah. The first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. The first rule of white supremacy is you don't talk about white supremacy.
Right.
And I mean, when I say you don't talk about white supremacy, I might have an apology if this says, well, I was in a anti-racism meeting in Grand Rapids after the, church massacre. Right. And they literally spoke for 45 minutes about everything, anything. The word white supremacy never came up. And it was like, when are we going to call a thing a thing? Like, you got to start by naming it, right? And that was in our faith, Union Universalism, had the white supremacy teaching. And a lot of people were really pissed about that. Like, really pissed. Like, the in a nutshell, the refrain was, just like you said before, we're white folk are conditioned to think of ourselves as inherently good and great and that racism is bad and that's not us. And white UUs are generally a little bit more liberal, a little bit more progressive, tend to be white, elder, and more educated folks. But they literally said, well, if we use the word white supremacy for us, how is that possible? How can we be, what does that make actual white supremacists? What does that make Klansmen? How can we use that word to describe our own actions and behaviors? They just couldn't do it. Couldn't do it.
Right. Well, you know, the, cause if we're going to describe ourselves that way, then we're equating ourselves with surprise white supremacy. Cause that's what we exhibit. That's what we live in. That's the water we live in, but we can't talk about it. So we're going to, let's just, a lot of people would have been happier if it had been called like an anti-racism teach-in, because then we're putting racism, which is the thing that we don't like, that we don't want to be like, and we're calling it, we're talking about how we're not going to do it. We're going to be anti-racist rather than, so we can separate ourselves and distance ourselves from that bad thing rather than recognizing and confronting within ourselves this white supremacy and the white supremacist systems that we're indoctrinated into, and recognize, admit, and figure out how we're going to fight that. No, you know, can't do that. We need to be anti-racist, not white supremacy. Yeah. It's just, it's backwards. I mean, I get it, right? Because I'm part of experiencing that too. That's been a curve for me without a doubt. I didn't even understand myself as being white, you know, for years and years. It took a very long time. I didn't think of myself as a race because I didn't have to.
Yeah.
That's a weird thing to not have to think of myself. And I come from, my folks were missionaries. I grew up in other cultures where I was a minority as a white person. When I was younger, up until about fourth, fifth grade, I was one of the few white kids in my schools. And yet it still didn't occur to me because whiteness is the prevailing experience, and it is the norm against which everything else is compared.
Yeah.
So I didn't, even in that experience of being a racial minority as a young kid, didn't occur to me what being white was until I really had to think about it in my like 20s and 30s.
Yeah. I mean, my journey included a period where I thought being colorblind was a good thing. I mean, I literally was like, oh, you know, I'm colorblind. I felt that deeply, that was a way to be and a good way to be. So journeys involve lots of different stops and stages. And for me, the biggest one was understanding that fragility is a conditioned response. Cause I would have these reactions and I literally would be like, wait a minute, this feels wrong, but this is what my brain is doing. And like, you know, a fraction of a second, all these equivocations and all the sort of stuff that we do as white people and the white fragility response. And I didn't get it until I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is an actual conditioned response over years and years of this sort of, you know, indoctrination into anti-blackness. And for me, it was almost like a relief. I was like, oh, gee, I can understand it now. Whereas before, and I assume a lot of white people do the same thing, it's so so uncomfortable. It's so kind of foreign. And because it's a conditioned response that you don't know what you don't know, you don't know how and why you're having it. You just feel uncomfortable and you want to avoid it at all cost.
Right.
And
make it stop.
Yeah, that makes sense. If you're most organisms in discomfort seek to eliminate the discomfort. So I kind of get it. But for me, it was just huge. It was like, oh, okay, this is how I'm meant to respond. Responding this way isn't, it doesn't make me a bad person. It makes me someone who's fucking been raised in a white supremacist society. Like, okay, good. I can deal with that. And now that I understand it, like, and I've said this many times on this show, that response still exists, y'all. It doesn't go away. I just recognize it and don't fucking act on it. You know, like, and when I say it doesn't go away, like, I've got beloved black family members and I'll still have like, you know, immediately fucked up biased kind of thoughts sometimes. Not often because, I'm getting better and better than my family members, but that shit doesn't go away. You know, it like literally doesn't go away. You just have to be like, wait a second. That's supremacist conditioning. That's not reality. Shut the fuck up. You know what I mean? And like, and for me, recognizing that and reducing the time with which I'm susceptible to the fragility response, like when that conditioned response is happening, you feel this discomfort. I've shortened, you know, I recognize it faster and I shut it down quicker and I feel less uncomfortable about it quicker, right? Because I know what I can do. It's like, okay, this is a conditioned response. Here's how it kind of happened. And we've talked a lot about just sort of naming a thing. And I pulled up Indivisible Alta responded the other day with a great summation. One of the biggest threats to white supremacy is the simple admission that it exists. White fragility reactions like the one to this professor's class are commonplace all of history, and they serve as a crucial tool for protecting and perpetuating white supremacy. And it's absolutely correct. You know, that's the white moderate, that the liberal white moderate that MLK talked about, right? Is maintaining these systems by being complicit, and you be complicit by having a white fragility reaction. It breaks down any possibility of discourse. And that's what these kids were trying to do to this Florida Gulf Coast professor. They were trying to en masse shut him down because they felt uncomfortable.
Right. And that's about, yeah, it's that tranquility. Don't upset me. Don't upset me. I think what I do a lot of crisis work and trauma work with people in some of my other work. And one of the things that, one of the things, you know, we're all connected, right? We're all connected. We affect one another. And so this happens, with people who are in crisis or who have experienced trauma, right? And then, so you can kind of imagine you got two people. You've got kind of maybe a care seeker and a caregiver, right? And so a care seeker often comes with a whole lot of energy, like something's just happened and their molecules are all bouncing off each other because this thing's just happened and they got a lot of energy and it's upsetting and maybe they're crying or they're yelling or whatever's going on and it's pretty big and those molecules are like flying all over the place. And then the caregiver comes in trying to be calm. But honestly, because we affect one another, if your molecules are falling up, flying all over the place like this, right? And they're moving around a lot, mine start doing that too, because that's what we do as people, because we actually are connected. And so mine just in sympathetic systems, right? They start moving around. Well, I don't like that feeling. I don't like that feeling. It's out of control. It's big. It's more. It feels chaotic. So I want that feeling in me to stop. The way it feels right now is in order for me to stop feeling this way, I need you to stop feeling that way. I need you to stop your molecules so that my molecules will calm down. Right? So I've got to stop this whole, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So I've got to stop this whole, shut this whole other thing down because my molecules, it's irritating my molecules and I don't like the way that feels and I don't like it. So make it all stop. Not, I'm going to stop it myself and you can have your experience that you're having, not being differentiated like that. Not saying, you know, you can have yours and I can have mine and they can be a little different, right? I'm going to be activated by somebody else's molecules all moving around.
Yeah, but then think.
But it's what do you do about it? Can I take a breath and go, oh, I can feel this happening. You know what? I don't have to react to that. And I can take my breaths and you can have your thing. And I think that's a similar thing that happens when you're talking about, you know, when we really talk about supremacy, because it kicks this stuff up. And it's, and when you just say the words white supremacy, the molecules start flying. They just start like clashing into each other, and it's like a cloud of molecules, right? In like a tornado, like a sharknado of molecules. And so that's going to upset my equilibrium. Well, rather than me just recognizing that and calming my equilibrium down so that I can pay attention to what's happening, I want everything to stop. So that means we have to stop all discussion. We have to stop the class. We have to stop acknowledgement. We have to stop all of that so that I don't have to feel crummy.
Yeah. And really the, and I'm chiming in on sort of this energy and this sort of focus. If somebody, and I'm using a different example than a race-based incident, but if somebody's got a headache, and they come to you and they're clearly in pain. They've got a headache. You can see they've got a headache. They're clutching their head and thinking, oh, my head's killing me. You don't ask about the headache. You don't ask to equivocate. Well, maybe you're not feeling that bad. Are you sure it's a real bad headache? What kind of headache is it? Is it like this? Is it like that? You don't question the person. You go, oh my God, let me get you some aspirin. Let me rub your temples. Let me take care of you. You jump into action. And so again, going back to sort of this fragility.
Well,
and
unless it's a black person or a black woman who's having pain, then you just, if you're white, you ignore it and you believe that, you know, they don't have pain the same way.
A white person with their partner, their spouse, whoever it is, that's how you would react, right? Your partner or spouse says, hey, I got a headache. You don't ask them to equivocate and describe it. You just kind of go into action. And so this fragility response that I have, and I still have it, it's still there. I just kind of cut it off. I have a equally opposite reaction to just general crisis. Like, so the flight or fight reflex within me when there's crisis, like when Leslie broke her leg, it's pretty immediate crisis. I had a level of clarity and action that's just, you know, like militaristic. Here's what we got to do. Boom, 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 boom. I got everything done. And that's just how I operate. Like, and it's, I recognize that it's a function of adrenaline and that flight or fight reflex. So when it happens, you just, all this stuff, these molecules are coursing in you and you take action. The exact opposite happens with racial based incidents. Like, it is a fight or flight reflex, but instead of getting a clarity of focus, I want to run away. It's all flight. It's all stop this. It's horrible.
Yeah.
And we should be.
Well, and this is where we get the all lives matter. Everyone, you know, we're all the same. This is where we're going to whitewash MLK, right? Because that's going to stop. That's an attempt to tamper down that thing that's making us uncomfortable. For some reason, it's also clicking in, and I've been thinking about a conversation, an online conversation I had with a relative, I think through Facebook, over the last couple of years, who is a person of faith, not mine, but they're Christian, and I mean, this is a relative of mine, and are evangelical Christian, and really was upset, but actually engaged with me in a dialogue that was actually kind of respectful. I was surprised because it's usually not, but was upset with how much I was posting about what was happening here in St. Louis and what was happening in Ferguson and then what was happening in other parts of the country and how wrong that was, because I was creating more division rather than doing what we do where I don't see color, right? Because that was what this person came at me with, is this whole colorblind thing. But then came at it, for them, it came down to God created all of us. And we're all God's creations. And so I was very wrong because I was saying that we're different, that black people, you know, that black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because God created all of us and God created us in God's image. Although this person would have said God created us in his image, which I wouldn't say. And so therefore, all, you know, race is just an idea and it's being exploited and on and on. And that was a heartfelt, I get that. And I've heard that argument. And my response to that is that I believe that that's true. I think we were created. I think we are all creations, you know, of a higher power. And I don't think that God created us inherently better, stronger, faster, all of those pieces. But the problem is that we don't treat each other the same. We don't treat each other the way God created us. Right. So it may be that God created us all equal, but since we don't treat each other as equal, since we don't treat each other that way, then the argument that we can't talk about this because God created us all the same, the argument is that we can't talk about it because that may be the truth is another way to try to avoid the, in their language, in what I believe in the language I would use with them would be the sin of white supremacy. That we literally do not treat one another the way that we were supposed to. And so, we have to look at that because there's a reality. There's a reality of how people are actually, their actual lived experience, which gets back to our believe, listen to black women, right? There is a lived reality that if we just want to say, oh, but that's not the way it was intended, that we're completely ignoring and therefore, and it's only for our own benefit so that we won't feel as bad.
Yeah. No one likes feeling bad, Rev. I don't want to feel bad. And to your point about religion, maybe you know as a reverend and scholar of this know better, but it seems like there's a vein of Christianity from the 80s onward, evangelical Christianity, that's actually latched onto capitalism as a sort of like Jesus wants you to thrive and prosper and make money. And capitalism is inherently supremacist. So, yeah. So churches, they could do a lot different. I always say I really kind of think I love and respect the prophet Jesus that walked this earth, but a lot of his followers are trash. I believe that there was a man named Jesus that walked this earth and, you know, I'm sure he did great things, but boy, a lot of his followers fucked up and maligned Jesus's words. Anyway,
get no argument from me.
there's no real way to end or leave this, but I wanted to just maybe I tweeted about it and I'll make a comment. We've talked about corporations, people fucking up, things being bad. And this is one, maybe I'll call it silver lining, bright spot I had. So this particular company's had a lot of negative press. Massage Envy has some sexual harassment issues pending. But I get a massage at my local place and I have a massage therapist that I use. And this massage therapist, I don't want to use their name inappropriately, but had a female name. And it maybe was gender non-conforming in presentation, but nevertheless had a female name. And Massage Envy sent me an email from this massage therapist announcing that they're using a different name, a male name. And the corporate even used the pronouns they and there in describing this this change. And they wanted to let us know just so that I wouldn't be confused and so that if I wanted to book an appointment with my favorite massage therapist, that there's a different name I'd have to use online. And I thought, wow, it's, I don't want to say impressive, but like one, I assume this individual is either identifying as trans or I don't know their personality, but is asked to be identified by a male name. And for the company to, I don't want to say embrace that, but I think it's great that the employees, A, still to be there and B, that the company, and I'm sure it's money driven. I don't think this is out of the goodness of their heart. I think it was, well, we don't want this massage therapist to lose money and us to lose bookings. But nevertheless, I was still kind of, I don't know, relatively pleased to receive that in my inbox. I was like, wow, okay. All right, Massage Envy, I see you,
Nice.
Yeah, wasn't, nice. I'm sure it was money. They didn't want to lose money with this therapist. Well,
but at the same time, we also know that for a fact that corporations will happily and individuals will do things against their own economic best interest to uphold prejudice.
Oh, for sure. Leslie says that all the time.
So it's got to be more than just money. I mean, one person is not going to like be able to sue them and take them down, right? It's a big corporation. So while, yeah, there's certainly financial incentives to doing the right thing, which is fine. That actually is supposed to be what capitalism is doing, is there's supposed to be financial incentives to doing the right thing. But somewhere somebody's deciding to also do the right thing beyond that. So that is a positive note.
Yeah, and the thing that got me was the they and there, because that was in the corporates. So there was a section that the massage therapist wrote their piece, and then there was a section that corporate kind of wrote their piece. And I don't know who, maybe the massage therapist had approval of it. I don't know. But I was really like, wow, they're using they and their. Like, goddamn.
So here, corporations, wow, if you actually pay attention to your folks that are in the marginalized people in your companies, you might not mess up so fast.
Hey, like, I'll tell you what, I booked an appointment that day and in the comments referenced it.
There you go.
You know?
You know, there are people that are paying attention to this, because those of us that are on the margins, folks that really are marginalized from marginalized communities, notice and pay attention to all of this stuff. And if you actually listened to them, paid attention, and gave a damn about it, it actually winds up being better. It's better for everybody.
Yeah.
It's
better for everybody. And to your point, we'll end it with this, the listen to Black women. And I've said this on this podcast. I know that the Reverend shares this sort of same view. We are not experts on race and racism, by no means whatsoever. I, however, might feel that I have some experience on journeying from, more to less harmful, because there is no end point. I'm not going to be non-racist ever. That's not going to happen. But I'm journeying to doing less harm. I think I'm qualified to talk about that journey. And I hope that's what Rev and I do, is talk about our journey. We don't talk about race and racism as experts, because we're not. We're not experts on racism. The experts are actual Black folk that live with the oppression of anti-Blackness. And so if you're a fan of Malcolm Gladwell and you know the sort of 10,000 hours philosophy, and I think there's some legitimacy and veracity to that. Well, Black folk, Black women, take it a step further, Black queer identifying women have, I don't know how many hours you have in a lifetime, but 10,000 times many, many, many more. They have hundreds of thousands of hours of living in a white supremacist society that oppresses them. So when they say, well, this was racist, this felt this and this was that, there's no reason to not believe them. They're the fucking expert. There's no, and we always do this. We don't believe them. We equivocate. I do this. I've gotten better, but at one point someone said, oh, I thought this was racist. And my first thought was, well, I don't really think it was that way. And I've never really experienced that. And I didn't think it sounded that way. You know, all that shit goes through your head. Stop it. Just believe Black folk, because they're the experts. They really are. That's why marginalized people, those that are oppressed, are the only ones that can set themselves and the oppressor free, because they know. Right. And Leslie's said this. I've heard her say it many, many times. She does work. She goes into various communities. There hasn't been not a single community she's entered where they A, didn't know exactly what their problem was, and B, what they needed to solve it. It's there. You just got, that's the, how can I help? Right. Marginalized folks know what they need. They know what they need. And that's why shifting power and resources, even just money, makes such a huge difference, because marginalized communities, they know what's needed. They're the experts on their own, life and autonomy. And then I'm going way tangent too many times, but that's an odd thing that I get accused of, or I should say Very White Guy's Twitter handle gets accused of, is removing Black folks' agency and talking about white supremacy and paternalistically treating Black folk, which I think is a strange reaction to talking about white supremacy, but... if that's what you want to do to believe that it doesn't exist, I guess. Anyway.
Stop those molecules. Stop them at all costs. So all right. before we end then, since you just talked about Leslie, I want to mention, because this will tie back in here, around safety pin box. And if that's not something that you're doing, take a look at it. They've got a great mini task that they posted around MLK Day. And it really, what they're asking you to do is – I won't go into the whole thing. Go check it out yourself. But look at the difference. Reflect on the differences between the whitewashed MLK legacy that were fed by white supremacy and the truly radical freedom fighter that he was during his lifetime. That's a piece. If you're thinking of anything you're doing this weekend, jump back to that. All the things that you see, what you're going to hear, jump back to that. And then subscribe to Safety Pin Box. Check them out, safetypinbox.com. They're on Facebook. It's an amazing community, amazing resources. And this is how you can do the work in accountable relationship. Can't say enough about it.
And distribute funds to Black women, right? Because it benefits Black women in a significant way. They give virtually half the money they bring in back to Black women.
Over $100,000. It's only been around for barely a year. It's probably closer to 120, I would guess, maybe 130. It's amazing.
Yeah, they've done great stuff. And they do have a lot of other products. So if you've got kids, there's the Safety Pin Box Kids series. There's one called the Ally Backpack, which is sort of for those in your life that don't quite get it. They don't know. They think there's a problem, but they don't understand it. So it's kind of a primer, kind of 101 course. And again, it's accountable actions. It's not going to allow you to sit on your ass. There's every month tasks that you can get out and start shifting power and resources, doing better, doing more. And, you know, I've said in the past that one of our, if you're not shifting power and resources, another goal and activity for a white person is to learn and understand and digest as much as you can about white supremacy and then disseminate that through all medias you can to other white people in your network, right? Educating other white folk. We hear this a lot, you know. Get your cousin, educate your cousin. And that's truth, absolutely a task of us white folk. Doing that in the context of safety pin box, meaning getting your education from Black women and compensating them for that education is huge. It's really, I'll just say in my I statements, I've benefited and learned from more from Black women on Twitter for free than I ever could possibly in any course, any other place. I don't know how I can even begin to pay them back. So I just throw dollars at them at Cash Me and PayPal every time I can. Whenever I retweet a thread or I read an article from a Black woman, I just mentioned Sharonda J. Brown and white women robes. I'll go throw her some ducats, right? And I do that as a habit, and not even much, even if it's just a few dollars. The habit for me is if I materially benefited from something you produced and you're a Black person, I absolutely have to compensate you for it because the world doesn't compensate you for your brilliance. And if I don't, then it's, and someone that you might know on Twitter, The Trudes, talks a lot about this. So The Trudes had, and I don't know if they're doing as much, but they used to have a website where they wrote a lot. And one of the things they wrote about was this consumption of Black ideas and Black thought and Black, you know, just folk on Twitter, just consuming this stuff in a kind of oppressive way. And that made a lot of sense to me in the sort of dialogue about paying Black women and paying Black folk. I'm pretty consistent about that. If I share or read something, hopefully I'm going to be sending you some dollars. And I'd like people to do the same and at least think about that. And that's a great thing about safety in the box is you can learn, get that education and not be consumptive, be supporting Black women and other Black queer and femme freedom fighters because it's vital.
I did that this week. I'm preaching this weekend, and somebody, you know, the congregation asked me to come specifically to preach about Martin Luther King, and a friend of mine, who's a Black woman, had a great blog post that changed entirely what I'm going to preach about, and so found her PayPal and sent her some money this week. Like, this is what we have to do. If I got an idea, like. That's for intellectual. It doesn't have to be intellectual property about suing people, right? But I'm getting inspiration. I'm getting something. I'm finding a place and a way. And so the right thing to do is to compensate.
Yeah. And something. I was on my list, but we didn't talk about it. And since we're not talking about compensation, I'll add it back to the spreadsheet list. There was a here in Grand, not here. When we lived in Grand Rapids, there was a, art prize show they did every year. It's a really big event and it attracts artists from all over the world. There's a jury prize that's $250,000. There's a public prize that's also $250,000. So it's a big deal, this art prize thing. So maybe 2 years ago, a woman of color, I think from the Middle East, won. Just a gorgeous installation. Something that, you know, and I'll put the picture on the link, but just absolutely beautiful. The Museum of the Bible straight ripped it off, took the entire concept, made it all Christian and biblical, whereas the original Woman of Color had it more world inclusive in terms of its, you know, it wasn't religious specifically, but it just, and you'll see the two pictures, but they stole it straight up. And when confronted, they just said, well, what she did wasn't trademarkable, wasn't patentable, wasn't unique in any way. So we're cool with it. Just straight stole it. And this Museum of the Bible, if you remember, was in the news for being in trouble for obtaining antiquities in some sort of fashion that might have been stolen from Iran. Like literally had the Iranian government like, yeah, you guys stole some shit. And here they're doing it to women of color. And just unconscionably, just, and like literally has their marketing person say, nah, this, you know, no big deal. She didn't do anything unique. Really? Because you fucking copied it like panel for panel. Mm-hmm. You must have thought there was some value there. Anywho, so subscribe to Safety Pin Box. Check out our awesome t-shirts at LeslieMack.com/shop. You can raise better white people, and there's one that says Black Lives Greater Than White Feelings. Whiteprivilege.info, which is woefully out of date, has some great information. There's links and lists of anti-racist organizations you can be a part of. This next beat, our sign-off, is framed by Feminista Jones. Help, don't hinder. Support, don't supplant. Cooperate, don't co-opt. solidarity, not charity. One person can make a difference. Your passion is a superpower. With that, we'll bid you adieu, and we'll see you on the next episode of the White Privilege Podcast. Thanks, Rev.
Take it easy.
All right. Cheers, all. Bye-bye.